Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Along with Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. And with our partners from the world, we'll keep you up to date this hour with national and international news, along with stories from Metro Phoenix and Arizona.
Arizona's musical tradition is long and storied, from the cowboy and cowgirl ballads from the territorial days all the way to rock artists. Tempe in particular has had a reputation for incubating musical talent. The Tempe History Museum is exploring the city's musical history in a new exhibit called The Tempe Sound, which is on display until October of 2015. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry took a tour.
This is what most people think of when they hear the term Tempe Sound, the jangle pop of bands like the Gin Blossoms. But if you dig a little deeper, you'll find that Tempe music goes back way further.
The earliest performer that we acknowledge in the exhibit is a gentleman by the name of Chipito Chavarria, who came out of the Tempe Barrios and started playing professionally in Tempe in the 1920s.
That's Josh Roffler, the curator of the exhibition.
He told me some great stories about what it was like living in Tempe and playing in Tempe, and about how important music was back then when it was really a main form of entertainment and really the force that brought the community together, and it was the thing that allowed people to be social and to meet each other is the weekend dances.
Most people recognize Waylon Jennings' Arizona connection, but may not realize that he has roots in Tempe.
He got his start as a solo artist here in Tempe in the mid-1960s. He started playing at a club called JD's, but Waylon played there seven nights a week and became popular locally, released his first solo album from JD's, and it was based on that popularity that he was able to go to Nashville and become a country music superstar. This is Chico Chisholm. He was a Chicago blues musician for a long time, but ended up moving to Tempe in the 1980s and established his own band here. And he was definitely a Tempe fixture for a lot of years, Chico.
Throughout the exhibit, there are photos and artifacts unique to each artist, like sheet music and a violin from Chipito Chavarria. And for Chico, a giant pair of steer horns that he used to mount on his bass drum, a reminder of his flamboyant personality. So, big band, country, blues, and also punk.
Party on the sand, bring your fans.
In the early 80s, it was this really, really active Tempe punk rock scene, and two of the bands here in Tempe that were a big part of that were JFA and the Meat Puppets.
JFA, which stands for Jody Foster's Army.
They were one of the first skate punk bands that really helped define that genre of skate punk.
And right next to a JFA skateboard is a display devoted to the uniquely cowpunk band, the Meat Puppets.
This right here is the first Meat Puppets 7-inch single. It's called In a Car. You know, the early sound back in 1981 was definitely more kind of hardcore punk. And then by the time they came out with the Meat Puppets 2 album, they were really getting very creative and bringing in a lot of, you know, country influences and Southwest influences and really developing a sound all their own that, you know, became really, really influential.
Influential on bands like Nirvana, who the Meat Puppets played with on MTV Unplugged.
Many a hand has scaled the grand old face of the plateau.
Once we start to get into the late 80s and early 90s, this is I think what immediately comes to mind for most people. It's the, you know, Chimeras, Pistoleros, Gin Blossoms, Dead Hot Workshop, that era of music.
Considered by many to be the grandfathers of the 90s Tempe music scene, Dead Hot Workshop and its members are deeply admired by many of their contemporaries. Probably the most nostalgic piece of the whole exhibit, a recreation of the stage at Long Wong's, one of the most adored music venues from Mill Avenue's heyday. It's got a large window framed by colorful, tacky curtains and a tiling that looks like punched tin. The stage is filled with beat-up Marshall stacks, a bright red drum kit, and even some styrofoam cups.
A lot of this equipment that we have, it's the same stuff that was used at Long Long's. I mean, these are Dead Hop Workshop's amplifiers.
Around the corner from that is a case devoted to the Gin Blossoms, and one to its iconic songwriter, Doug Hopkins.
He wrote a lot of the songs that people think of when they think of that Tempe sound from the 1990s.
Throughout the exhibit, you're reminded that all of the artifacts, the ticket stubs, the show flyers, the t-shirts, the instruments, were donated by bands and fans.
What it tells me is that this stuff is really important to people. It brings back memories for them.
And even though Tempe continues to undergo many changes, it's still a place that lots of musicians call home. Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News, Tempe.
The holiday season is about celebrations and gift-giving surprises. There's one surprise Arizonans receive every holiday season. You may have noticed it on the way to northern Arizona. Our guide, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, travels north to tell us about it.
It's become an unofficial holiday tradition in Arizona, a juniper tree in the middle of Interstate 17, decorated every year for the holiday season. Did you know the tree has been trimmed for about 30 years, and who does it is a mystery?
The flasher on. I've got a truck, so I'm going to pull over to the left now. Try to keep us safe.
I went to visit the tree with Arizona Department of Transportation spokesperson Doug Nintzel. The tree is located north of the Sunset Point rest area, past Black Canyon City. And no, it's not a tourist stop.
Wait for some traffic to clear, and then we can get out and we'll make a quick run over to the spot. Okay, we've got our gap.
Okay. Cars whip by as we try to walk fast through overgrown grass and bushes.
Watch your footing. I don't think it's snake season.
Oh, thanks for letting me know about that.
What looked like a small tree from a distance has now become much larger. It's not all that pretty. It's round and bushy. It's about 12 feet high and adorned with melon-sized ornaments and large makeshift cardboard candy canes, wrapped gift boxes, and ribbons. Nintzel says he remembers when he first saw it.
My memory goes back to either the late 70s or the early 80s. I was a student at NAU, and I have memories of coming by and seeing the tree with decorations not as elaborate as you see nowadays.
Nintzel says for years the decorations have popped up before Thanksgiving and come down mysteriously after New Year's. He says the tree has become a highway icon, so much so that during a recent wildfire, people came around to protect it.
Flames got right to the base of the tree, and some ADOT workers were here, some passersby, I think a firefighter or two, and they wound up being able to beat down the flames.
Under the tree is a makeshift irrigation system. It has four small barrels with plastic tubing used to water the tree. ADOT spokesperson Nintzel says it's a mystery who does all this.
Really, that many years and you don't know?
Well, I can tell you, I've had people tell me that they know who does the decorating of this tree, but they have never told me who it is. And I kind of like that because I like to keep the mystery alive.
It's a long stretch between northern Arizona and the valley, so a mysterious Christmas tree in the middle of nowhere may just add a bit of holiday spirit for that long ride home. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
And in case you were thinking about getting out and adding decorations to the tree or taking photos, keep in mind stopping in the median is not allowed. If you have ideas or know things we should know, send us an email, theshow@kjzz.org.
Still to come, the holiday tradition of tamales from a local Phoenix restaurateur. That story in 20 minutes on KJZZ.
It's Thursday, December 25th. Happy holidays. Looks like it should be a gorgeous weekend with sunny skies and a high near 60.
It's the show on KJZZ. The show is a stream of curated stories from Phoenix, our region, and stories from around the country. With help from our partners at The World Today, we're mixing news and stories from our community and the globe to keep you up to date and entertained.
Good afternoon, it's The Show with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Happy holidays. This afternoon, along with our partners at The World, we're keeping you connected with stories from Phoenix and around the globe.
Today is Christmas, but this has been a time of celebration for thousands of years predating Christianity.
The winter solstice was officially on the 21st. On that day, we have the least amount of daylight all year. To explain the relationship between the heavens and the earth, we turn to University of Arizona astronomer Tom Fleming. Dr. Fleming, I get these confused sometimes. Remind us what the difference is between the solstice and the equinox?
The equinoxes are the two points in the Earth's orbit when direct sunlight is hitting the equator of the sun. So the sun appears to be right above the Earth's equator, and those are the two equinoxes. The solstices are the two points when the Earth's north pole is the most it's tilted away from the sun and the most it's tilted towards the sun. The solstice, the winter solstice for us, the one that happens on December 21st, is the day of the year where the sun spends the least amount of time above the horizon.
Take us back in time. How has knowledge of the skies historically played a part in the way people lived and ordered their lives?
Well, when you think of ancient cultures, and it isn't just the ancient European cultures, those that were here in the Americas or in Africa or in the Polynesian islands, they didn't have television, the internet. So what did you do to keep yourself amused or interested when you weren't trying to survive? And that is, you looked up at the night sky. And so they were very, very aware of the objects that appeared in the night sky, be they stars or planets or the moon or the sun. Now, for many cultures that were agrarian, it was very, very important to look at the sky because they had to live their lives at the whims of the weather. So it was the sky that gave early cultures, first of all, their first calendars. That's why we have days and years, because they would notice that the sun would appear in the east and then appear in the east again.
Mm-hmm.
And that period, in our language, is called the day. Also, they noticed that compared to the background stars, the sun appeared to move through those stars. In the Western world, we refer to them as the zodiac constellations. And so that's where the concept of the year came about. And, of course, the year coincided with four distinct seasons.
And so what about this season? Why was the winter solstice so significant?
The solstice was the marking, the winter solstice, that denoted the beginning of the season of winter. Now, the reason that was so important to them is because, and you have to realize for many of these cultures, what they saw in the nighttime and the daytime sky not only connected with their folklore, they made up stories about it, it also connected with their religions. And many ancient cultures saw the objects in the sky, like the sun and the moon, as gods, and that the objects in the sky, the wandering planets, the sun, the moon, and the stars, affected their daily lives. This is also where astrology began. So it was noticeable throughout the autumn that each day the daylight hours were decreasing and getting shorter and shorter, and the nights were getting longer and longer. Well, the 21st of December is basically when that trend stopped, because the next day, the 22nd, and the next day, the 23rd, they would start to notice the sun would start rising further north on the eastern horizon and setting further north on the western horizon. And it took a few days to realize that all of a sudden the daylight hours were extending. The days were getting longer and the nights were getting shorter. So that meant, well, a rebirth, that once again it's going to get warm and in a few months it'll be time for planting again. and the sun is coming back. And if you viewed the sun as your God, well, your God is coming back home to you, because now it's getting closer and closer to you after moving away from you for the last 6 months.
Tom Fleming is an astronomer at the University of Arizona.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ for Thursday, December 25th. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news, blending everything that makes our world what it is.
The typical Christmas main dish usually features turkey or ham. But when you live in the Southwest with the culinary influence of Mexico, the plate looks a little different. Tamales are a tradition for a lot of us in Arizona, whether we can make them ourselves or have to lean on the experts. Arthur Othon is part of the family that owns the El Bravo restaurants in the Valley, which specialize in tamales. I asked him how the tamale tradition got started.
Grandmothers, my mother-in-law, and their families, everybody would get together before Christmas, and it's kind of like an assembly line where all the tías, which are the aunts, would get together and they'd, put an assembly line to make tamales. And that would be a tradition for Christmas. But it expanded to most of the Hispanic or Mexican families still do that today.
But what got it started so that was the great product? Because anyone who's had a good tamale knows how great it is. But why did that become a Christmas time tradition?
Obviously, Christmas is a time when families all get together, and that's where they used to have the feast for them would be the tamales. The general population would cook a ham or cook a turkey. Well, the Hispanic families, and primarily the Mexican families, would all, cook tamales, and they do it as a group to cook tamales, and then all the relatives would come over and celebrate Christmas, and that would be the feast.
What makes a great tamale?
It's the preparation, the dough. We don't use any animal fats in our tamales, so it's a lighter type of masa, they call it in Spanish, that is the main piece of the tamale. That's what you spread on the corn husk. And then you put whatever fillings you want. Tamales come in all kinds of flavors. They have the sweet corn tamales. You have sweet bean tamales. You have nowadays the vegetarian tamales with enchiladas and beans without any meat, without chicken or beef.
When you talk about the assembly line, how long does it take to make a big batch of tamales?
Well, obviously, it's a lot quicker here at the restaurant than it is in the home.
Yeah.
The restaurant, we have the big batch machines that stir and prepare the masa. But on the families, it's all done by hand. When you do it at home, the tamales are prepared by hand. The masa is made by hand. The ingredients are put in by hand. The corn husks are spread by hand. So it's an assembly line. I would say probably a couple of hours to make maybe 20, 30 dozen tamales.
Do you have a personal favorite flavor of tamale?
Oh, yeah. Mine, it's the chicken green corn tamale. But I also like the red beef chili tamale for the breakfast with a fried egg on top.
Ah.
And that, to me, is you're in heaven when you do that.
That's great. Do you have a first piece of advice for someone who's never had a tamale before?
Yes. The most common mistake when they first eat a tamale is they try to cut through the corn husk. Peel the corn husk off. We serve the corn husk on the bottom of the plate for decoration when we serve our tamales, but it's not edible. Well, it probably is, but it's not very flavorful. So just make sure you don't eat the husk.
Arthur Othon, part of the family that owns the El Bravo restaurants in the Valley.
And finally, the New York Times recently came out with an article saying classic hip-hop is the newest popular radio format.
Stations across the country are starting to play Biggie, Tupac, and LL Cool J again, just like it was in the 90s. Boy, Mark, this is almost like you and I are reliving our childhood.
Seriously, I feel like I'm back in the junior high gymnasium right now, awkwardly watching people dance.
How about wearing your parachute pants? I'm kind of picturing you there.
Yeah. They were too legit to quit.
Oh, God.
The show is produced by our senior producer Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Alexandra Olgan, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer, Maria Springs, and Aubrey Abril are our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. The show at KJZZ.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix in HD. Have a great rest of your afternoon.